Thank you all very much for coming today. I'm going to keep my introduction short so that we have plenty of time for the review and for discussion afterwards. I would just like to say that when the Random Review Committee selected Amy Waldman's novel as submission, today's reviewer, Ari Menounsepaire, immediately came to mind as an ideal reviewer for it. He's an author himself, author of a compelling and lyrical memoir entitled We Heard the Heavens Then, which is about his childhood in Iran. It was nominated for a 2013 Oregon Book Award and has received other awards as well and was very widely reviewed, quite favorably, in various national publications. Ari moved with his family to the United States from Iran in 1979. He has lectured on issues concerning Iranian culture and U.S. foreign policy, and while at Susquehanna University, he created and directed the Forum for Middle East Awareness, where he also taught world and Middle Eastern literature. He now lives in Corvallis, where he is a faculty member of the Wood Springs Institute teaching creative writing. He's an active member of the community, and last year was the MC for the Magic Barrel event to raise money for the Lynn Benton Food Share. The Random Review Committee was pleased indeed when Ari responded immediately to the invitation to review the submission, saying he would be delighted to review the book.
Thank you for that introduction. Sorry, I forgot to turn this on. Is this better?
Yes.
Yes and no. Okay. Thank you so much for being here. A few things before we get started. Let's see. Okay. So if this turns into a problem, I'll go back to old school mic. Thank you, Mary, for that introduction. So I'm told that not everyone has read this book, that's not something to be expected here, and that some people might be halfway through, and of course some have finished it, so it's a wide audience to talk to. I'm only mentioning this because when we get into Q&A, and you'll see in my presentation here, I'm not really getting into much of the plot beyond halfway, only because I think it might give away some things for people who are eager to finish the book and see what happens for themselves. And you can hear me fine?
I can't hear you at all.
Okay. Okay. Well. All right. So let me begin with an admission. To a problem, in fact. I'm not sure when exactly I fell into this pattern, but I've always plotted through books, looking for interconnections, the meaning behind the meaning, successes, failures. I don't know why, but I suppose I take words pretty personally. In short, I think I read like a writer. The entertainment aspect of literature is often lost on me, or put another way, I find entertainment in literary detective work. For instance, what does the title of Amy Waldman's book, The Submission, really refer to? I'd love to get your ideas later when we have Q&A. I have some ideas. Let me start with a disclaimer, then, that what I'm about to get into is heavily tinted by my own process. The Submission is one of those hard-to-place novels that could easily lead us into genre debates. I thought it would be useful to take a quick look at the contours of these discussions before we try to make any pronouncements about the work itself. After all, without knowing what we're dealing with, we run the risk of applying the wrong metric, I think. I'll go on a limb here and claim that The Submission is a work of creative nonfiction that drifts to the side of fiction. Two metaphors in one sentence should sound some kind of alarm for you, and you'll find it more unsettling still to hear that I believe writing generally is rooted first in the middle ground between the hallowed poles of fiction and nonfiction, and only then moves toward the one pole or the other. My second disclaimer, I'm a creative nonfiction writer. As it regards the submission, the fictional bias is unquestionable, of course, but it's more of a kind of a Tower of Pisa bias, I think, not something that's, say a building that's toppled over and is far from its provenance. Historically and academically, we've viewed fiction and nonfiction with immovable certainty. One is thought to be a product of pure imagination, the other, of course, impeccably grounded in truth. But is the difference so clear-cut? Many writers have weighed in on this. Lee Gutkind, the so-called father of creative nonfiction, says, quote, "Most fiction on some level is true. How much doesn't matter, since fiction must be believable." I'd stress here we're talking about the amount of truth in fiction and not its presence or absence. But exactly how is the truth determined, asks Gutkind? How much of what is being told should be true, and who is the final arbiter of truth? The writer John Edgar Wideman places the collective effort of writing in, quote, "imaginative truth-telling in communication that gives the lie to language as fact." All information, he says, includes a point of view, intention, and author. Facts pretend this isn't so. I would only add fiction to the list of pretenders. Norman Mailer and Truman Capote were most aware of this delusion. They tried at some point to broaden fiction with a new label, the nonfiction novel, they called it. In Cold Blood is a perfect example of fact running through fiction and fiction running through fact. Michael Chabon did it more boldly in Wonder Boys, disguising real characters and situations to the point of impropriety and concern, in fact, for reprisals. And of course, there have been legal reprisals for, quote, fictional accounts that too closely mirror a real-life character. On the other side of the debate, Tom Wolfe and Gay Talese were responsible for, quote, new journalism, the move to push nonfiction closer toward the middle. In short, we're looking at a complete mess. Pure fact has been reduced to what Gutkind calls, quote, his or her own very precious and private and shifting truth. The most inventive fiction is thought of as truth bricolage. Some writers, like John Edgar Wideman, accept the tumult and look beyond. Wideman says, "The line between fiction and nonfiction for me are more and more arbitrary, blurred, and problematic. In many senses, the distinctions are non-existent," he says. "Does a photo document or fabricate an event? Is life composed of facts or a constructed fiction? Both," he says, "always." He goes on to say, "Good work seizes the reader's attention, enforces its unique version of reality." Other writers revel in this turbid water, if you would. "I don't distinguish among literary enterprises," trumpets Richard Rodriguez. "My essays are stories. My essays are poems. My essays are dramatic monologues, even jazz compositions." I'm going off on this academic tangent because the submission is squarely placed, I think, in this debate. It taps as readily into fiction as it does into fact. And when it falls short, it invents articles in Time Magazine, for instance, or the New York Post without batting an eye. The work reacts to fictional content from CNN, MSNBC, or Fox News, so apropos, they might as well have originated in these sources anyway. It reflects on a made-up comment from the president of Iran, for instance. Susan Sarandon gets a minor role. The overlay is seamless enough for you to think genre discussions were a thing of the past, that fact and fiction had, in fact, coalesced into a new form. Well, they have. Or, as some might say, there never was a barrier between the two. Either way, the form is called, or this is how we refer to it today, called creative nonfiction. And I think it's only fair to judge the submission by its criteria. I'll come back to this at the end, but for now, let's turn our attention to what any literary endeavor grapples with, namely style and substance. The book is based on, of course, the events of September 11th and the political atmosphere surrounding its aftermath. The opening chapter places us in 2003 in Manhattan, New York. A jury has been elected to pick one of the few thousand anonymous architectural submissions for the new memorial planned for Ground Zero, and the book opens with the panel's closed-door deliberations. They've narrowed their choice to two designs, what they call the garden and the void, and by the chapter's end, with all the deliberations and power brokering out of the way, the garden wins. Sorry to give that away. It's only 20 pages. You've lost. There's nothing exotic or even exciting about the design, the garden. But the design has a major supporter in a character named Claire Burwell, one of the central characters in the book, whose husband was killed in the attacks. Claire is affluent, has two children, mingles with the New York elite, and she's very principled. She praises the design for being a place where we, where the widows, their children, anyone, can stumble on joy. From the architectural sketches, we learn that the garden is, and I'll give you a little description here from the book, a walled square garden guided by rigorous geometry. At the center would be a raised pavilion meant for contemplation. Two broad perpendicular canals quartered the six-acre space. Pathways within each quadrant impose a grid on the trees, both living and steel, that were studded in orchard-like rows. A white perimeter wall, 18 feet high, enclosed the entire space. The victims would be listed on the wall's interior, their names patterned to mimic the geometric cladding of the destroyed buildings. The steel trees reincarnated the buildings even more literally. They would be made from their salvaged scraps. So if you can imagine this kind of a quad, essentially, with a canal running right through it. I'll come back to this maybe in the Q&A, but it's good to kind of have a mental picture of it. In fact, if you have the book with you, some of the section breaks try to mirror the design. So this is actually what I think what they're talking about. Okay, so I must spoil another early plot development, namely that the design winner is a man by the name of Mohammed Khan. Mo, as he is known to his friends and colleagues, is an American of Muslim descent, and nothing more is known of him except that he already has been, quote, cleared, which is to say, he is probably not an extremist. Mohammed Khan is, in fact, an architect of an established New York firm. He's 30-something, a non-practicing Muslim, progressive, he has a sharp analytical mind, and he has decided to grow a beard. You can see the problem there, I hope.
What are you doing with a beard?
You can't design this thing with a beard and be a Muslim. The conflict of a Muslim designer for the 9/11 memorial forms the backbone of the submission and is the plot line on which everything else is built. It's remarkable, in fact, to note how much the author is able to make of this simple dynamic. I can just picture one of my own friends over a beer or two thinking of the same irony. But it would be just as easily dropped or forgotten. To chase this threat as much as Amy Waldman has is, I think, truly remarkable. I was looking for elements of style as I made my way through the book. The best uses are those that go unnoticed, of course, and when they pop out and are in your face, I can't help but wonder why. Am I looking at a deliberately skeletal Eiffel Tower? Or am I confronted with the St. Louis Arch that has lost a section of its exterior form? Unfortunately, in the submission, I don't think you can tell. All the classic elements are at play here. Plot, setting, characterization, symbolism, conflict, foreshadowing, point of view shifts, snappy dialogue, internal monologues. But Amy Waldman's abiding interest seems to be in her characters. The external conflict that shapes the plot is mirrored by the internal conflict of the two main characters, in fact. A recalcitrant, Khan, refuses to give in to questions about himself and his inspiration. What are his views on Islam? People want to know. Could his design, so indebted to Muslim tropes, be a quiet nod to Muslim terrorists? A martyr's paradise, people think, is what he's made. Khan believes because the jury has selected his design anonymously and nothing in the competition rules mandate any further investigation, questions about the designer are immaterial, if not intrusive. Except, however, he is privately torn. Shouldn't Americans have a problem with a Muslim designer of a memorial resulting from Muslim fanaticism, he thinks? Claire wrestles internally with her own choices. On one hand, she is the garden's and hence Khan's greatest supporter. The garden has won, fair and square, and it would be an affront to American values to reject it based on unfounded assumptions about its designer. On the other hand, she sees that the project will cause more injury than peace, bring greater pain and discord than repose. The mere mention of Muhammad Khan has already divided New Yorkers, enraged the survivors, and caused violence. There's some headscarf pulling as well, which I won't go into. How could Claire not see the disaster awaiting the construction of a memorial meant to unite an ailing nation? That's her debate. Such internal struggles overlaid on the plot driver work until the reader finally faces some unavoidable questions. Why can't Khan reveal himself in the interest of greater public good? Why can't Claire soften her views on, quote, American values when in their support she threatens the very nation they are meant to honor? The two characters vacillate inordinately to the point that they become less and less believable. They turn into ideas, theoretical positions. The what-ifs keep getting recycled. This is unfortunate because the story has a solid backbone of a plot, and though it plateaus in the middle, the ramp up toward the end is actually quite thrilling. Many other characters appear in this work, and I don't mean to limit the assessment to the two I just mentioned, But the others, like Paul and Sean and Layla, the lawyer, Asma, the woman from Bangladesh, Alyssa, the reporter, Governor Bittman, or Debbie Dawson, lack complexity. Compared to Claire and Khan, they're flat and predictable. This isn't a fault or a shortcoming. These peripheral characters, I believe, are in place to drive the plot, and in this sense, I think they do a fantastic job. Substantively, the submission is much more ambitious than any stylistic effort I think it makes. It tackles immense issues, leaps without hesitation into the roughest waters around. Some of Amy Waldman's questions are monumental, of Ayn Randian proportions, I might say. And like her Fountainhead, it needs a Howard Roark type character, an archetype, to carry the questions around. Back to Claire and Khan. What was faulted as a stylistic flaw earlier here turns into an asset. The two are exactly the kind of prototypical idealists to hoe deep questioning furrows into this work. This comes at a price, though. In being so clear about its ideas-based agenda, the book weakens the reader's sympathies halfway through. These characters, we realize, are simply here to serve the grand purpose. But the grand purpose is truly, I think, grand. The big idea in this novel is the tension between national identity and religious or ethnic identity. Khan is a Muslim of an American Muslim, and an embodiment of the two factions up in arms over the memorial. One side is narrowly American, and think of Irish descent, sort of American. The other side contains Muslims of all kinds, ethnically, nationally, even religiously diverse. In a land that values plurality, what happens when the nation's historical interests have to defer to inclusion? The danger to America isn't just from jihadists, says Geraldine Bittman, who is supposedly the governor of New York in the book. It's from the naive impulse to privilege tolerance over all other values, including national security. Muhammad Khan has brought us face to face with our own vulnerability, she says. Waldman broaches other ideas that are offshoots of this central question. For instance, how are we to make sense of Muslim American women who don the hijab in a country that prides itself on the women's liberation movement? One outspoken critic of Islam in the book, a character named Debbie Dawson, calls it dimitude, the voluntary submission to being second-class citizens under Sharia law. The question really isn't about headscarves or the chador or any hijab. It's about the role of a citizen. Have we accepted that all citizens are equal in the same way? Why do we enforce different gender-based dress codes in this society then? Why were women until 2 weeks ago barred from combat duty? Why is homosexuality still literally a punishable crime in some states in this country? This idea of the headscarf or the hijab or in some parts of the world, in Iran, for instance, the chador, is much more convoluted than this book attempts, anyway, to discuss or to present to you. Because while we get this idea that, well, women are submitting themselves to this kind of program voluntarily, we meet another character in the book who claims that this is what women want, that this hasn't been imposed on them culturally or in any other way, that this is an actual choice. I'll give you, I have some insight into Iranian politics and, you know, history. Back in the Shah's regime, this is before 1979, when Ayatollah Khomeini was agitating for change. Now, this just so you know, again, before 79, this was a country that favored tolerance, right? So anyone could wear anything they wanted, much like here. And the issue that, I mean, and Khomeini's, of course, program was extremely religious, right? He would impose Sharia law, right? And this had become kind of a joke, right? Well, like, who in our society would want to subject themselves to this program? I mean, if you wanted to do it, why not do it already, right? Why do you need someone to come and actually enforce it, right? As it turned out, this is exactly what happened, right? So Khomeini showed up, and there was supposedly a referendum to have an Islamic government, and the government claimed that there was a 99% vote to have this pass, and to in fact be forced to wear the veil, or the chador, as it were. Let me go back even more in time and tell you about what happened in the 30s in Iran with the Shah's father, who showed up on the scene to modernize this nation. And this is an anecdote I know from my own family. My father says he was about 10. This would have been about 1942 or somewhere around there. And a policeman. So the chador was banned in Iran, and of course no one listened to it because this was their dress code. They were used to wearing stuff like this. So my grandmother and my father are walking around, and a policeman shows up and actually, strips her, essentially takes her chador off and says, "Well, this is illegal, right? There's a law against this." Anyway, so this, she gets really emotional and, cries and runs home and stuff like that. So you have the two extremes. You have, where the chador is enforced on one hand, and people, of course, are very upset about this. Some factions are upset about this. And you have a case where it was actually banned in the same country within 50 years, right? Neither of which answers the question, right, which actually comes up in this book. Why would you want to have this enforced? Why would you want a dress code, right? And I think that kind of opens a line of discussion here, which, again, I'd love to hear what you have to say, because it's not as easy as it might sound. No one's enforcing it, really, and when it is enforced, it's a problem. When it's not enforced, it's a problem. So I want to ask, why would anyone want to do this? Anyway, moving on. Identity issues, or more specifically, whatever sanctity we feel for our citizens' identity rights, question some fundamental aspects of American values. Is Khan in the right for not revealing anything about himself? Is there a particular American moral superiority in saying we have no right to ask? He has won, after all. He's been picked anonymously, and nothing in that compact stipulates further disclosures. But what about a nation reeling from an Islamist attack? Is it not reasonable to know if the designer of the most emotionally charged national monument is himself a jihadist? And where do we draw the line? Could we also ask if he's gay or bisexual, or whether he eats monkeys or pork? This nation did, I think, exactly that. That is to say, it vacillated when it signed off on torture in Guantanamo, right? I think that the issue of values really became, front and center, and it was conditional. Yes, we value this deeply, personally, except when we can't. Yeah. Enforcing us anyway between Scylla and Charybdis, if you would, Waldman demands that we re-examine our commitment to our American values, to question our faith. So So I want to come back to these questions, the three that I'm posing here, namely women's rights, the nature of what are American values. I'd like to know what you have to say about this. And anyway, I said I would come back and assess the book with the right metric applied to the right medium. And I'll go back to, again, Lee Gutkind, this father of creative nonfiction, who offers the following for writers who dabble in both fact and fiction. He says, as writers, we intend to make a difference, to affect someone's life over and above our own, to say something that matters. This, he says, is why we write. After all, to have an impact on society, to put a personal stamp on history, to plant the seed of change. In this, this is what he values. In this rubric, we have to admit Amy Waldman has succeeded. She has planted, in fact, several seeds of change, and their impact on the society could be great. But as a little sugar suckers the administration of any pill, so too does an idea-based novel benefit from the stylistic magic show, if you would, that hides the real program, right? This is why I think where the book falls short. In my opinion, we're a bit too aware of the author's agenda, making the submission feel 100 pages too long for me. But is this book a book that matters? I think absolutely yes. Let me stop there with this and open it up for discussion, because I think some of these questions because I think Waldman raises questions and doesn't necessarily answer them. I'd love to know what you think, if you have questions about Islam, or if you've read the book, maybe what your impressions are, and maybe we can start by asking, what does the title even mean?
Good.
Who has yes?
That's what I would like to know, what you think the title means.
Oh. Turn it back around. Okay.
I'm not sure.
Well, there is the very superficial read that the submission is the architectural design that this Muhammad Khan has, of course, submitted to the competition and so on. So that's the submission. On another level, there is a submission of women to this dress code, and it comes up actually in those terms, right? That women have submitted to a program that's imposed on them, right? This again is challenged by one of the characters in the book who says this hasn't been imposed on us. This is what we want, right? Which is exactly what was kind of so unbelievable in the Iranian Revolution. How could you possibly want someone to enforce this on you? This is what the character is saying. But I want to come back to this. Why would you want this? Why would you want to put a headscarf on? I mean, how does it make any sense to, say, be involved in sports? If you go online and look around, there are some very funny and quite untenable, in fact, situations that limit women in the world, right? I mean, you can't quite run around in a chador, right? So I sometimes give some talks about Iran, and one of the things that when women's issues come up that I put up is the women's soccer team in Iran. I mean, of course, they can't have anything shown, right? So, and it's unless it's in the middle of the winter, I don't know how they're playing soccer in that country. So there's the submission as the architectural, in its architectural sense, in the competition. There's submission of women to this dress code. Of course, the big one is, yes?
The dress codes, though, can really be taken so much further. Like, we have dress codes to go into a restaurant so people don't go in barefoot. On a team, it's really helpful to have the distinguished, the two different teams to look different. To have sometimes it's to show that, you know, when kids go to school, they're supposed to dress a little, you know, not necessarily, you know, playful attire, but to have a little bit of a spruced up appearance, and that shows a seriousness of what they're going to engage in.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, the dress code is something that helps us a lot of policemen. We know we can, you know, turn to someone in a uniform. And, you know, there's a lot of helpful things about dress codes.
Sure. So let's come back to this. But let me just finish up with the title, and I'll address your point here in just a second. Yeah.
Well, I think there are unspoken and spoken rules in any culture that we submit to. Some people submit more willingly than others.
Uh-huh. Nice one. Okay, good. I didn't follow that one. The big one that she hides, I think, quite well in the book is that the submission is actually, it refers to Islam. In fact, Islam means submission to the will of God. That's what it means, right? So that's kind of nicely tied to the title. Also, there's another, I guess, a level that's not so complex or hidden, namely that there are two camps in this story, right? The ones that favor the architectural design, regardless of its designer, right? Because, well, who cares what its design was? There's a jury, they decided to go with something, and there's an ethical problem here in trying to find out, well, who is the designer now, right? And this other camp who has found out who the designer is and who claims, well, maybe he's not suitable for the design, right? So these two sides are kind of clashing. Submission on this level is one side, I think, submitting to the other, to the will of the other, right? To finding compromise, and they don't, honestly. Some of them, you know, think about how this might happen, and then, you know, again, the book, I don't want to give too much away, but the book addresses the problem in being able to submit to the different camps, right? Why can't you cross over and say, okay, yes, I'm a Muslim, and I'm not with this program, or I'm an American who has a problem with jihadists, but I don't care who this guy is. There are significant problems there. Yeah.
This is slightly off the title, but you were saying it's possible the author didn't answer the questions. I was in Baltimore when the big brouhaha came out about the proposed Muslim structure on very near Ground Zero. And I said to my daughter, well, I don't understand why everybody's upset. I mean, what I mean is, why is everybody upset that everybody's upset? Isn't it inevitable that people will be upset? I mean, and she said, that's all I was asking. And she said, anybody should be able to put anything there. And that wasn't my point. I was not being intolerant. And then we just argued with her because I couldn't get her to see my point was, why is she surprised? People are surprised and upset. And then I thought, wow, that'd be a great subject for a novel. Really, but it's in some ways, that's what I looked at this whole book as Waldman thinking, wow, that'd be a great subject. How would this have worked its way out? And so the whole business about the dress code, that's just one of the symptoms. That's just one of the things that was going to happen when everybody was working out this fear and conflict. And that leads to a question I had throughout this book. You called upon a non-practicing Muslim. And I never really understood how Muslim was being used in this book. Muslim means you're a follower of Islam, right?
Correct.
I mean, that's like, you can be a non-practicing Catholic, but it's different from being that doesn't make you a non-Catholic American. You might be Irish-American or Polish-American. Where did his parents come from? I forget.
Yeah, so his parents had come from India.
So he's really Indian-American. I mean, or Pakistani-American, whatever. I mean, the use of Muslim for him always seemed really weird. It means he's a follower of Islam or he's not, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, is it truly an ethnic term? I honestly don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not ethnic the way Jewish is ethnic.
Yeah, no, it's a great question because I don't think it's all that well settled in the Islamic world.
Oh.
Yeah. So whereas, you know, you would find someone of the Jewish faith, right? They would immediately, I think, again, from my friends who are Jewish, they would identify with that label, right? First. And then they might say, I mean, I have many Jewish, my family does, many Jewish Iranian friends, right?
Yeah.
They're first Jewish, and then they're Iranian, right?
Yeah.
So when they see other Jews, there's kind of a common language there, right? I don't think Islam is all that clear-cut about stuff like this, because for one thing, it's not a religion that's uniform, right? The Islam that's practiced in Iran, for instance, is what's called Shia Islam. Most everyone else is a Sunni Islam, you know, Muslim. Why this is a problem is because the different the Gulf, I mean, and many variations, right? The Shia version of Islam in Iran believes in 12 saints. Well, there's another Shia version that believes in 7 saints, not the other 5, right? And then it goes on and on. Assad himself belongs to a very small sect that's Shia, but very different from the Shia that's in Iran.
But he's still basically Syrian.
But he's Syrian, exactly.
Between a nationality and religious association.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Made very clear.
It's true. He's still Syrian. So as I'm saying, so your national identity becomes a lot more, say, important, right? This book doesn't present it like this, right? This book, it's all the Muslims are the same. In fact, there's a council that has decided to back this design, right? And the council, you meet them, and they're very different from one another. They have kind of extreme views, but they all meet in the same room, and they decide, well, they're a council. One of the members of this council is an Iranian lawyer, who the book, her name is Layla, right? Layla is the only one in the room who doesn't wear the hijab. In fact, she's in a skirt or suit type of thing. Very Western in her attitude and her, you know, hair, flowing hair and all this kind of stuff. And the book claims that she is actually, she's doing this, she's dressed like this to make a point that although she's a Muslim, right, Islam isn't about the dress code, right? These are the problems with trying to, I think, in my book, in my estimation, the book tries to feed us some things that are superficial,
yeah.
Right? No Iranian woman that I know in the West has this kind of program. They don't intentionally not wear the hijab to make a statement. It doesn't even occur to them to wear the hijab, right? It would be like me asking you, why are you making a statement today, coming to this like this? No, this is the way I dress, right? Waldman presents it in this way, that, well, she's a Muslim, right? She has to have this in the back of her head, that she has to dress like this, and, oh, this has to mean that she's taking a stance. When, in fact, I don't think that's quite correct. So I think I'm not quite answering what
you are.
Am I? Okay.
Yeah.
So Islam itself is extremely broad, and to lump everyone together as one thing, you know, against the American program is to me a little unfortunate, because for one thing, why aren't we seeing anyone on the other side being a Muslim? People who are Americans, right? Who are, you know, who have been, against their religion being reduced to an Islamic kind of fundamentalist thing, right? And in fact, if the designer is a jihadist, right, a Muslim would be the first in line to probably say, I don't want a jihadist to be representative of, right, this kind of work. So the boundaries are a little artificial, but I think the questions are good questions still, right? What, for instance, what does this hijab mean? Why the dress code? So going back to your point, you know, it's one thing, I think, to require professionals to be of a certain, maybe kind of a, to look a certain way, but to subject half of society to a certain mandatory outfit or, you know, article of clothing, I think runs into, you know, civil rights issues, right? At the same time, it's, again, it's not as simple as that, you know? It's true what this woman is saying. I mean, we, in Iran, we experienced this thing. In 79, people said, bring it on. We want the, right? We want to be forced. We want everyone to be forced to wear this thing. Again, my question is why? Why would why do you think they people anyone would want to be forced to do anything?
Takes the decision out of their hands.
Are you looking for an answer to that, or are you?
No, I am looking for an answer because it's puzzling to me. I mean, I have some ideas, but I'm curious to know what you think. I mean, is this do you think it's oppressive to subject women to the headscarf or different variations of it, the burqa, the chador, all kinds of, you know, Islamic...
I've seen people right here in Corvallis totally covered up even with their only their eyes revealed.
Yeah.
Right here in Corvallis. I'm thinking, why are they doing that?
Yeah. I call it the reverse of Zorro.
Well, we submit our, you know, if someone else was saying, but really it's a very sex-based thing, only the opposite in our society. In some ways, if you look at a professional level, you go into any office, and for a man, professional dress is a suit. And women have much more opportunity. You know, even at the highest professional level, they can wear the dress, they can wear a pantsuit. And we look at Hillary Clinton, a lot of different wardrobe choices, more color, more jewelry, more accessories. Man is suit, tie, leather shoes, period. That's all you know. So, and that is something that we sort of blindly without even thinking about it.
No, yeah. So we have many blind spots, I think, in this topic. I mean, I thought about coming in here with a kilt today, but I thought, can I? Should I?
Yeah. I think a lot of it, and not to sound like a quintessential American, but gets to the thing of choice. I mean, but even as we're talking about you expressing some interest in seeing a woman fully covered except for the reverse zero effect, I'm thinking of the Mennonites when I go down to the Peoria Bakery. I mean, they dress in a very particular, to me, restrictive fashion. And one thing that's always fascinated me about Islamic women who choose to cover, you touched on this a little bit, is the degrees of it. I mean, in Afghanistan, women have, to me, which is the worst, the burqa, but they're in beautiful colors. I was stunned the first time I saw a color photograph of them. I assumed they were black. They're actually lovely if you're not inside of one. And then in Iran, is it more covering, but your face can be shown? In some, it's just the veil. I've noticed young women on campus with their heads fully covered, but they're wearing they'll wear high heels and very tight-fitting clothing. So if it's done in the name of modesty, it's like, I don't know. It's confusing to me. I was raised Catholic, and I'm 60, so when I first started going to school, those nuns were completely covered with voluminous cloth and big rosaries. And as I got older, by the time I graduated from high school, they wore very short head coverings and dresses to their knees. And you could see their bangs. It was a big thing to see the nuns' bangs. I mean, I think there's more degrees of covering and dress code even in, quote, U.S. society than people realize. It's just we choose to look at something which seems more extreme.
Thanks for that. Yeah. Bangs are in Iran.
In the White House, too.
Yeah. Sorry.
I want to get back to the book.
The book.
Yeah. And I have not read it. And
I hope I didn't give too much away.
No, it was fun. And I get the sense from what you said that some of the characters, maybe the lead characters, are pretty two-dimensional. Okay, set that aside. Each reader who comes to this book brings themselves and what their backgrounds are to it. Do you get the sense that Amy Waldman knew that and wrote the book the way she did to stimulate more questions than acceptance of what she had written?
Yes, absolutely. I think that this question has much more to do with questions than answers. I hope I was pretty clear. The two main characters, I don't think, are two-dimensional. I think they're quite well developed. It's all the other characters that I think are flat and, well, just predictable, as I mentioned. The two main characters, their complexity, unfortunately, is played out too long. So, you know, they go from one pole to the other, back and forth, to the point where, okay, well, I get it, right? Let's move beyond this. That's what I said. I mean, I think if there were 100 pages shorter, I'd like it a lot more. This is not to say it's not a good book or anything. I think it is powerful. It has good questions.
By way of possible explanation for some of those shortcomings that you mentioned, Amy Waldman's background is as a newspaper reporter, so that probably colored her way of looking at things. And it's her first novel. So we should give her a little leeway as to who knows what she may come up with next time. Having two well-developed characters is pretty good. I mean, most novels have none.
No, I agree. I think I'd be extremely happy if I had written a novel like this and if it were my first novel. Sure. I think it's quite triumphant in that sense, yeah.
Where does editing come into play in this, too? Was the novel sufficiently edited, do you think? I know it's another subject.
Yeah. No, I think on that level it works really well. Having gone through some editing kind of process myself, it's really, I think the vision is there. I mean, somebody, her editor or herself, thought that, okay, this works. We need to spend more time with these characters. And it becomes really a subjective thing, so. But I think they read it wrong, honestly. You'll see, maybe you can, you're the final judge of this. I mean, who cares what editors say, right? You read it and you think, okay, no, this was perfect. The length is just, it works for me. For me, I guess my subjective view is that we're spending too much, there isn't enough to, right, the characters, yes, are perfectly developed, the two main characters, but they're developed too long. Right? It's important to give the can you hold on to that idea, ma'am? That's my wife. I like to give the reader some I like to think that my reader is more intelligent, I guess, than I'm than it yes. The lady in the brown coat.
Having read the book, that one of the reasons that we might have the impression that it goes on a little bit longer, that the interaction between the two main characters seems to drag out, is that these characters are inscrutable to each other. Like, the two main characters represent really different worldviews, and the architect character is extremely closed off and, kind of feels like expectations are being placed upon him that he shouldn't have to answer to. And so he's deliberately very cagey and unwilling to be forthcoming in terms of his ideas, if he got them, and so forth. And the wife, the character who is defending his proposal, needs to know, she wants to understand him at a deep level so that she can really advance his project, and he won't let her go there, so that they're dancing the whole... That's why it goes on so long. They're dancing back and forth. They're not really able to or allowing each other to understand the other person's position. So I think that's part of the reason why it keeps pinging back and forth.
Sure. But I think,
don't feel like you get anywhere sometimes.
With yeah, but I think the dance goes on perhaps after the song has ended.
I wonder if one of the problems with the fact that many characters are flat is that characterization isn't why she wrote the book. She was writing about this, the way we solve clashes of culture and groups interact in this country and how that goes wrong. And if the whole point was just to outline where we are failing in our society to handle some of these problems, the characters may have been used merely to make this point and not have mattered to her that much.
I think you're right. I mean, I finished by saying, does this book matter? And I think it does matter. I think she's done a great job at addressing, or at least broaching some topics that we need to talk about. Namely, the stuff I kind of briefly touched on, right? What are American values, and how willing are we to stand behind them, right? What about, I mean, we didn't get into this too much. It's 1 o'clock, so of course I can stick around and talk to you if you like. But what about, what was I thinking? I had a fleeting thought here. What about this comment from the governor that really our this naive what did she call it, a naive commitment to tolerance or something like this? She says the danger to America isn't just from jihadists. She says, right, it's the naive impulse to privilege tolerance over other values. Well, I would submit that tolerance is one of our is central value to us, right? How do we privilege? How is it naive, right? I mean, I alluded to waterboarding out there, you know, a little bit there, but it that really disturbed me. Not just because it was kind of a disturbing act, but because we stand behind the way these values. We take it personally, right? I don't care who has done what, but we've committed to some kind of convention, right? The Geneva Convention. We're signatories, right? How do we turn around when it suits us to do so?
It seemed to me that one of the things the book pointed out most adeptly was how our veneer of tolerance and some of the other things we espouse as Americans and think the rest of the world should idealize us for is really a very thin veneer. And we go back to being the hurt human we are pretty quickly. And that 9/11 gave her this perfect situation to show how easily our principles can be scraped away from us and we become the hurt second son of a family who doesn't have a good job. Or we become the aggressively chauvinistic female lawyer who's representing her culture, she thinks. And we become these people, who we are emotionally, rather than who we are idealistically. So easily.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. That's a great point. That tolerance might be a veneer and not so deeply rooted as we'd like to think. Well, I think, but again, this is the success of the book, is that it forces us to re-examine what it means to be tolerant. How far are you willing to go? Would it be okay for you if the winning designer was in fact a jihadist? Would you go? I don't care who it is. Nice design. It's not that simple. Yeah, exactly. Thank you for coming. I'd love to talk to you again.